Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 400, titled This Earth Island. This is being recorded on February 23rd of the year 2003. The title of the program is an allusion to a famous or relatively famous 1950s science fiction movie called This Island Earth. And the pun, This Earth Island, is a reference to the concept developed by the German theoreticians, many of whom significantly influenced the Third Reich, of the concept of the Earth Island. I've explained that at some length and in some detail in other programs. Basically, an entire landmass running from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe and Asia, all the way through to the Pacific, is a giant landmass containing most of the world's population, most of the world's petroleum reserves, and over the middle of it is a large stretch of Muslim population, which for all of their anti-Arab racism, the Nazi geopoliticians saw as essential to the control and domination of the world, and hence some of the links between the Third Reich in its above-ground and underground phases and elements of the Arab and Muslim population that at root they actually despised. But that was second to hatred was second to anti-Semitism and anti-British, anti-American, and anti-Soviet dogma, and hence the utilization of those populations in a Machiavellian fashion. Now, before I get into the main body of the broadcast itself, note that on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com, which is equipped with real audio, there are article-length descriptions of the programs, and there will be an article-length description of For the Record 400 on the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this broadcast. Note also that For the Record program 391 is a long description and summary analysis of the major points that I have brought up in my analysis of September 11th and related topics such as the impending, it would appear, war with Iraq. And I am updating For the Record 391's description periodically to include additional information. So for a summary of the analysis of September 11th and related events, For the Record 391's description at spitfirelist.com in the For the Record section. Sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on real audio. More recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, DaveEmory. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL that is linked both to the Spitfire website and to the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website. Now, to the main subject material of This Earth Island. In the past, we've spoken about the utilization of various groups in the Underground Reich's attempt at achieving world domination. One of the things we've spoken about at considerable length was the Oklahoma City bombing and evidentiary tributaries linking the Oklahoma City bombing to the first World Trade Center attack in 1993, as well as possibly to September 11th. Programs that deal with that, For the Record 330, For the Record Program 373 and 380, and For the Record Program number 386 cover these evidentiary tributaries in detail. Also, For the Record 398 and 399 discuss the Turner Diaries, the source of inspiration for Timothy McVeigh, and a disturbing similarity between the climactic event in the Turner Diaries, which is a low-level suicide attack on the Pentagon by the Order, the Nazi terror group that's featured in that novel, and the actual attack that took place on September 11th. There was an article about the Oklahoma City bombing and indications that, in fact, Timothy McVeigh was connected to white supremacist groups. The following was accessed from the Yahoo website at yahoo.com. This is an AP story by John Solomon, an AP writer. It's headlined, FBI linked McVeigh to group after bombing. This is a longer development of a story we covered in For the Record 399. It reads in part, FBI investigators in the Oklahoma City bombing gathered evidence linking Timothy McVeigh to white supremacists whom the government had been told before the bombing were threatening to attack government buildings, investigative memos show. Several of the documents were not provided to the bomber's defense before he was convicted. And the FBI agent in charge of the investigation says he never received one teletype from his own headquarters that raised the possibility McVeigh was aided by other accomplices. By the way, I would add that many of these memos were actually destroyed before Timothy McVeigh's appeal had come to fruition. But skipping down, last week we reviewed information that was presented by Carol Howe, an ATF informant who had infiltrated the Elohim City compound and who passed a lie detector test. Carol Howe testified that Andreas Strassmeier, a German Army veteran and an intelligence veteran, who was in turn the son of Gunter Strassmeier, Helmut Kohl's chief of staff and the architect of German reunification, and in turn the great-grandson of a charter member of the Nazi Party under Adolf Hitler, Carol Howe passed a lie detector test indicating that Timothy McVeigh was Strassmeier's protege and that it was Strassmeier who had actually planned or was instrumental in planning the Oklahoma City bombing. More about Carol Howe's testimony is carried later in this article. Carol Howe, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms informant who had provided information that Elohim City members were discussing an attack, was sent back to the compound in late April of 1995, parenthetically I would add after the attack. Howe talked with one member of the compound who, quote, discussed alibis for April 19, 1995 and the components of McVeigh's bomb, investigative memos show. The same member had claimed before McVeigh's bombing that he had detonated a 500-pound fertilizer bomb similar to the one McVeigh later used. That compound member also discussed the name of a munitions dealer that McVeigh's phone records showed the bomber called more than two dozen times in the weeks before the attack. McVeigh had the dealer's phone number in his wallet when he was captured. One of the points that's worth noting about Elohim City and Carol Howe and Andreas Strassmeier is that because Andreas Strassmeier, at least according to Carol Howe, as well as other information that's been developed by other researchers, was in fact deeply involved in the Oklahoma City bombing conspiracy, despite his claims to the contrary, and despite the fact that there were obvious links between Andreas Strassmeier and other Aryan Nations elements, such as the infamous Kirk Lyons. Andreas Strassmeier was obviously not brought back to the United States, and one of the things to consider as we evaluate the geopolitical struggle of which September 11th is part, of which the Iraqi situation is part, and as I've said in the past, I believe that this is a continuation of the Second World War by a Third Reich gone underground more than a half century later. One of the things to consider is the fact that the United States has the death penalty, that had Andreas Strassmeier, for the sake of argument, been convicted of conspiring with Timothy McVeigh, he would have been sentenced to death. Europe, on the other hand, does not have the death penalty. This would have hastened the growing rift between the United States and Germany, and I suspect, and I want to emphasize this is conjectural, I suspect that the prominent position of Gunter Strassmeier, his relationship with Helmut Kohl, his relationship obviously with his father, Helmut Kohl's chief of staff and the architect of German reunification, was deliberately exploited by the underground Reich in connection with the Oklahoma City bombing, and that much of the reflexive cover-up that took place by the FBI and other elements of U.S. intelligence had to do with State Department considerations. And basically, had Andreas Strassmeier been convicted in the Oklahoma City bombing, he would have been executed. This would have hastened the rift between the United States and the European Union that, in my opinion, is being deliberately exploited by the underground Reich, and that is using elements of the left and people whose democratic and peaceful sentiments are not to be impugned in any way. But in true Machiavellian fashion, the underground Reich, what I have called a virtual state in the past, borrowing from University of Texas Professor Philip Bobbitt, the underground Reich is exploiting elements, including many elements that are not aware of how they are being exploited. Revisiting and supplementing an item we've spoken about in the past, and that is the Balkans Wars. And one of the reasons, and I want to stress in this context, I am not in any way anti-German, nor do I in any way impugn the very significant democratic and peaceful instincts of the German people. And the German people themselves have very well-developed and peaceful instincts. But what I'm talking about here are the German institutions, which, unlike the German people, the German people were reamed in World War II, but the German institutions, their corporations, their military, and their intelligence community learned a very different lesson from Second World War, which is that they would get away with what they could, what they had done, and that the German people would end up suffering for what they had done, and hence the Underground Reich has been perpetuated through those institutions and through the institutions of other countries and other societies in an underground fashion. One of the reasons I do not buy, as an acquaintance said, when you see the epicenter of the world peace movement located in Germany, that should make you suspicious, and that's quite true. The very first act of reunited Germany was to precipitate the Balkans War. To make a long story short, as discussed at some length in For the Record 154, available from WFMU for download on Real Audio, the very first act of the newly reunified Germany was to precipitate the first major land war in Europe, the Balkans Wars, and that was basically a German show, although the U.S. provided much of the military muscle, utilizing, basically because they were sincerely anti-communist, they were being manipulated by Germany and the Vatican. At Maastricht in the meeting that basically launched the European Union, the vote was 11-1 against breaking up the Yugoslav Federation, because the European peoples knew that breaking up Yugoslavia would reignite the long smoldering centuries-old Balkan tinderbox with the centuries-old animosities that ranged in that area between the Serbs and the Croats and the Muslim populations of Bosnia, Albania, and Kosovo. Under the European Union governing statutes at the time, the European Union had to have a unanimous vote. But Germany voted against the rest of the European Union and basically twisted the arms of the rest of the European Union. Basically, the dissolution of the Yugoslav Federation was mandated by Germany, which held the rest of Europe and the impending European Union hostage. Again, it was 11-1 against dissolving the Yugoslav Federation. Germany alone voted to do that and held the rest of Europe hostage. And as indicated in For the Record 154, they proceeded along with the Vatican to basically to endorse the secession of Slovenia and Croatia, and basically to launch the Balkans Wars. We've talked at great length in the past about the German sponsorship of the neo-Ustashi, so to speak, the Croatian fascists that were at the core of the reestablishment of, quote, independent, unquote, Croatia. What we're going to do now is to review some aspects, and this is again in the context of the discussion of the Earth Island. We're going to review some aspects of some of the Islamo-fascist and Third Reich heritage of some of the Islamist elements that came to the fore in the newly, quote, independent, unquote, Bosnia-Herzegovina. Reviewing an element or citing an element that reviews some of our discussion of Bosnia as a base for Islamo-fascism and Al-Qaeda-related elements, we're going to examine a section of an article from the Wall Street Journal of February 20th of 2003. This is an AP story, Dateline Washington headline, U.S. says documents show charities aided bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. This refers to the Benevolence International Institution, an Islamic charity that had been abused by Al-Qaeda and Islamo-fascist elements to help basically channel money from sincere Muslims who were performing their duty of zakat to Al-Qaeda and related terrorist and Islamo-fascist elements. I would note that Enam Arnout, the head of Benevolence International, initially denied that he was in any way involved with terrorism, despite the fact that he was posing with rocket launchers and assault rifles with bin Laden. Eventually, he flip-flopped, skipping down in this story. Though the original documents remain secret, federal prosecutors described their contents, and English translators for the first time in the filing unsealed this month in a case against BIF's head in Arnaout. Mr. Arnaout pleaded guilty last week to illegally buying boots and uniforms for fighting forces in Bosnia and Chechnya under a deal in which prosecutors, in exchange for his cooperation, dropped charges that he aided Mr. bin Laden. So basically, Enam Arnaout copped a plea. What we're going to do now is to present some information for the first time and to review some information from previous broadcasts, including For the Record program number 293. And this concerns some of the fascist heritage of some of the elements that came to the fore once Bosnia itself began splitting off from what was left of Yugoslavia. I want to note that this is a work that needs to, as is the case with many books, it needs to be ideologically handicapped. This is a book called Some Call It Peace, subtitled Waiting for War in the Balkans. It was authored by Josef Bodansky, Bodansky, published in soft cover by the International Strategic Studies Association, which is an intelligence-connected think tank. This book was published in soft cover by ISSA and copyrighted August of 1996. Its ISBN number is 0-952-0070-5-3. Now, in For the Record 293, among other programs, we discussed the revelations of Milan Bulahic, who was the head of the Holocaust Museum in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, and someone whose politics are left of center, and in turn, someone who's accessed information from the government of the former Yugoslavia. And this discusses Alija Izetbegović, the first head of state of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Alija Izetbegović, as a young man, was associated with and recruited for the Hanjar Division, the 13th Waffen-SS Division, composed of Bosnian Muslims, and recruited for the Third Reich by Hajimin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, key Axis spy, major in the SS, and also, not incidentally, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement. Yasser Arafat was a protege of Hajimin al-Husseini, as well as Odessa leader and SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny, something that is conveniently overlooked or not known at all by apologists for the PLO and Arafat. I would note that there is a confluence, and an important confluence, between Milan Bulahic's discussion and analysis and those of Josef Bodansky. Bodansky's work needs to be handicapped, for example, in discussing the rise of Islamism and Islamofascism in Bosnia. He attributes this largely to Iranian sponsorship of these elements, and there certainly was an Iranian role in this. He almost completely overlooks the Saudi role in this, and so again, it does need to be handicapped. But when one reads Some Call It Peace, Waiting for War in the Balkans, it's quite apparent that this book, which again is published by an intelligence-connected think tank, has some very concrete intelligence about the weapons formations, tactics, even some signals intelligence for the combatant forces in the Balkans. And as such, I think its revelations concerning the military formations of Bosnia-Herzegovina under Hanjar Division veteran Alija Izetbegović are worth reflecting on. Now, when Alija Izetbegović appointed his deputy defense minister to begin the reorganization of the combatant forces of the Islamists in Bosnia-Herzegovina, he appointed a man named Hasan Cengic. And Hasan Cengic, spelled C-E-N-G-I-C, was also a veteran of the 13th Waffen-SS or Hanjar Division. Reading from Some Call It Peace, the reassignment of the Mujahideen was completed in February and March of 1996. This dispersal was more than just the concealment of individuals forbidden to remain in Bosnia-Herzegovina. This dispersal was but one, albeit very important, aspect of a far more profound process, the reorganization of the army of Bosnia-Herzegovina to meet future challenges. In early 1996, official Sarajevo was stressing its ultimate objective, namely that, quote, by next summer, 1996, the Bosnia-Herzegovina army will have become a regional power, unquote. Indicative of Sarajevo's intentions and priorities is the appointment in January of 1996 of Hasan Cengic to the position of Deputy Defense Minister, the man in charge of the implementation of the reorganization. A veteran of the SS Hanjar Division during World War II, Cengic is a very close personal friend and confidant of Ali Izetbegovic, especially since the time they served together in Yugoslav President Tito's prison, skipping down. Cengic has repeatedly argued that the only key to the salvation of the Izetbegovic administration is by adopting an unambiguous Islamic identity and waging an Islamist struggle. Considering Cengic's strong and known positions, his nomination to such a key post, Deputy Minister of Defense, means that his position has been adopted by official Sarajevo, and then of the launching of one of the top military units of the newly, quote, independent, unquote, Bosnia-Herzegovina. Another major Islamist force remained, the Hanjar Division, named after the 13th SS Hanjar Division, which served under the German flag in World War II. The current Hanjar Division is Sarajevo's Praetorian Guards and is comprised of 2,500 to 3,000 elite force deployed in Sarajevo and a 6,000 to 7,500 strong backup force at a major training base around Forodnica, but it is moved around to augment major fighting fronts. The majority of the troops of the Hanjar Division come from the region's non-Bosnian Muslim minorities, primarily Albanians, and are led by veteran Pakistani and Afghani efforts. More about the Hanjar Division and its force projection into other areas of the Balkans. Skipping down here. In mid-1993, Sarajevo revived the Hanjar Division with all its fascist culture and preoccupation with the division's role as worthy successors to its SS predecessors. The primary role of the Hanjar Division is a Praetorian Guard for President Ali Izetbegovic and other senior leaders in Sarajevo. The Hanjar Division is comprised of a 2,500 to 3,000 elite force deployed in Sarajevo and a 6,000 to 7,500 strong backup force in Forznica. Significantly, the majority of the troops of the Hanjar Division are not Bosnian Muslims. Instead, they come from the region's other Muslim minorities, primarily Albanians, and are led by veteran Pakistani and Afghan efforts. Quote, surprisingly few of those in charge of the Hanjars in Forznica seem to speak good Serbo-Croatian. Many of them are Albanian, whether from Kosovo or from Albania itself, unquote, explained UN officers in Forznica. Quote, the Hanjars are trained and led by veterans from Afghanistan and Pakistan. The strong presence of native Albanians is an ominous sign. Bear in mind, this book was published in 96, and it was obviously to a certain extent prophetic. Continuing. It could be that the seeds of war are spreading south via Kosovo and into Albania, thence to the Albanians of Macedonia, unquote. These observations made in late 1993 proved correct. By 1995, the Hanjar Division has been transformed into a zealot and combat-proven special forces. In many cases, particularly in the surge into western Bosnia-Herzegovina in the summer and fall of 1995, they operated in close cooperation with the Mujahideen units. The deployment of Albanian veterans and support Mujahideen cadre to Albania began in the fall of 1995. Note that obviously the conflict eventually did spread both to Albania, Macedonia, and to Kosovo. Many of the people who fought in the Kosovo Liberation Army, with its own links to the Al-Qaeda milieu, were in turn the sons and grandsons of a number of Albanian Balkan fascist fighting forces, including the 21st Waffen-SS Division, which was composed primarily of ethnic Albanian Muslims, most of them from Kosovo. So again, the fascist heritage here is not to be overlooked. What we're going to look at next is an article that highlights some of the difficulties in assessing the Iraqi situation. I want to state for the record, I don't believe that the Bush administration's case for war in Iraq has been made convincingly. This does not mean that it may not be justified. I will state for the record, so to speak, that with all of the rhetoric being kicked around, I don't know. I think there may very well be a case for war in against Iraq. I don't think that case has been made effectively. If I had confidence in the Bush administration, that might solidify my view. But I think this is a situation that has been drastically oversimplified by both sides. Personally, I will state for the record, I don't know. I do think that the analysis that has been presented is predictably inadequate because it does not view Iraq like the situation with the PLO, like the situation with Al-Qaeda, in terms of the geopolitical struggle that is going on between what I've called Germania, the German-dominated European Union and the Franco-German axis in particular, and what might be termed Anglo-Saxonia, namely the U.S. and Britain. In analyzing the situation vis-a-vis Iraq, I think that there has been gross oversimplification. The Third Reich heritage of Saddam Hussein, the racist and fascist influence on the Ba'ath Party, his uncle, has not been adequately discussed. And indeed, there are evidentiary tributaries that connect the Oklahoma City bombing and a number of apparent Middle Eastern nationals associated with Timothy McVeigh, possibly Iraqis. That has never been positively established, but it does appear that there was a fascist third position milieu involved with Iraq. And I want to take note of the following article. This from the Financial Times of Thursday, February 13th of 2003, and we're going to continue with this story in the second side of the program, by Mark Huband, H-U-B-A-N-D, the Financial Times security correspondent in London. This article is titled, Al-Qaeda Connection Not Ruled Out. And this is not to endorse the evidence presented or the quote evidence, unquote, presented by Colin Powell. But rather, one of the things that's pointed out in this article is that there are documented historical links between Saddam Hussein's regime, which is a secular Arabo-fascist regime with a strong Stalinist influence, and members of the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. And we've talked about the Muslim Brotherhood at great length, about the Al-Taqwa milieu. For those people who might view some of my discussion of a Third Reich heritage to much of what is going on as ridiculous, note that in the Treasury Department's, in the U.S. government's own list of individuals involved with financing terrorism, we have Yusef Mustafa Nada, who himself had worked as a spy for Nazi Germany in World War II, or as an agent for Nazi Germany in the Abwehr, according to Egyptian intelligence. And we're going to continue with this discussion of the links between, historical links between Al-Qaeda and the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, and contacts, though not necessarily operational links, between Saddam Hussein and the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, but we're going to do that in the second side of the program. The various programs, For the Record programs, are being archived on Real Audio by WFMU. Recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are archived on for download only at a longer URL linked to the first WFMU address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Analysis of the 9/11 situation in For the Record program 391, periodically updated. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 400, This Earth Island, being recorded on February 23rd of 2003. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.